It's one small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Cindy.
This week in history.
Well, I wonder if you dream of owning a piece of paradise, perhaps your own Pacific island, or you're not alone. Guam is such a place. It's located about 2,200 kilometres north of Papua New Guinea, and while the waters that lap its shores are calm, the island's modern history has been anything but. This week marks the anniversary of the capture of Guam by the US from Spain in 1898. It was one of the shortest military campaigns in US history. They seized the island in just under an hour without a single shot being fired. That event transformed Guam's future and has tied it to the United States for more than a century. Well, tonight we're going to look at the history of Guam since that fateful day and also its place in the Pacific today. Now, Dr. Michael Bevacqua is a Chamorro scholar and author. He's taught Guam history and the Chamorro language at the University of Guam for 10 years and is also a curator at the Guam Museum. Now, I understand, Michael, I'm going to say Hafade, which means hello. Did I get that correct?
Oh, yes. Thank you. And Hafade to you, too.
Hafade. Okay. Welcome to Nightline. Paint a picture for us, Michael, about Guam as a place.
Oh, well. So Guam is, there is a song that says Guam is good, Guam is hot, Guam is just such a little spot. And so Guam is about 220 square miles. Wherever you are, you're just a few minutes from the beach and beautiful sandy beaches, jungles filled with history, ancient remains of the villages of our ancestors, the ancient Chamorros. But you are just as likely to see coconut trees on Guam as you are to see U.S. military fences. And so part of the reality of Guam is that it is a beautiful tourist paradise. It's the home of the indigenous people, my people, the Chamorro people, but it's also a strategic U.S. military base as well.
And we might get into that a bit more. Now, and this is something we were wondering in the office. What do you call someone from Guam? If you know, someone in Australia is an Australian, what do you call the people from Guam?
And so an indigenous person, of course, is a Chamorro. Mm-hmm. But it is common to call anybody from Guam, regardless of their ethnicity, a Guamanian.
Guamanian. Okay. Mm. Well, let's go back to before Europeans arrived. Who are the Chamorro people? When did their ancestors first settle in Guam?
And so the Chamorro people settled the Marianas about 4,000 years ago. And that settlement is one of the earliest in the entire Pacific. And so there's still some debate about where our earliest ancestors came from. Did they come from Indonesia? Did they come from the Philippines? DNA evidence provides new clues. And so pottery evidence, linguistic evidence, all of these things have, you know, give us some insight. But more and more, we're leaning towards the idea that about four millennia ago, people came in canoes over 1,000 miles from somewhere in Indonesia.
And Michael, these are obviously your ancestors. Well, what can you tell us about Chamorro society before outside contact?
Oh, and so Chamorro society, of course, across millennia would have undergone many different changes. And so some of these changes, you know, we can't know a lot about because of the disruptions in oral history, the lack of written records. But we do get a good picture of what Chamorro society looked like a few hundred years ago, right before Spanish colonization took place. And Chamorro society was one in which many people lived atop what are called lati stones. And so these are stone megaliths, you know, that were built into two pieces, the capstone and then the pillar. And so a lati could be 3 feet tall. The tallest are 16 feet tall. And on these megaliths, Chamorros elevated their homes off the ground. Chamorro society at that time also was a seafaring society. And so for those families that lived in villages along the coast, canoe culture was very important, and Chamorro sailed and had trade relationships with other islands, you know, throughout the Marianas, other islands in Micronesia. And Chamorro culture was a matrilineal culture. And so your female, you know, your relatives through your mother's mother and your grandmother, these were your most important relatives. And this is something that actually shocked the priests when they arrived, is that the Chamorro women had an incredible amount of authority compared to what European women did. Chamorro women controlled the home. Chamorro women had control over their bodies sexually. And so, yes, there was a lot of differences at that time that Europeans, priests in particular, didn't appreciate when they first arrived several centuries ago.
Yeah. I've got Dr. Michael Bevakwa here, a Chamorro scholar and author. He's taught Guam history and the Chamorro language at the University of Guam for 10 years and is a curator at the Guam Museum. Now, Ferdinand Magellan and his crew were the first Europeans who arrived in Guam in 1521. Was Guam one of the first Pacific islands encountered by the Europeans?
Oh, yes. In terms of sort of the, you know, the Pacific Islands, Guam is the first inhabited island that sort of Europeans encounter, and then later it is the first that is colonized. And so, you know, when Ferdinand Magellan, when he is attempting to circumnavigate the globe, when they're attempting to cross the Pacific, you know, Their hubris does them in a certain way, because they anticipate that trying to cross this new ocean for Europeans will, you know, just take a few weeks. Getting from one end of the Pacific to the other actually ends up taking several months. And so by the time that they are crossing this big unknown expanse of blue, they are low on food, they are getting sick, they are low on morale. And so by the time that they encounter Guam, and the Marianas Islands, you know, they are ecstatic. And the first thing that they actually see when they encounter Guam is a fleet of canoes, sakman, as we call them. And so the first sight that Magellan has, and his, we see it through his scribe, is actually they marvel at the seafaring prowess of the Chamorro people. One phrase in particular comes to mind, that the canoes of the Chamorro people leap from wave to wave like dolphins, and they surround Magellan and his ships, and just in time, they offer vegetables, fruit, water, fish, all sorts of things to Magellan and his weary crew, who are very much in need of sustenance and some support after their longer than expected journey.
Now, Michael, that sounds like a nice first encounter, but things quickly go southwards, don't they?
Oh, yes, definitely. And so, of course, Magellan and his men, you know, they eat this food, they take it. But it's customary across the islands that, you know, if you're going to take something, you must offer something in return. And so Chamorros, after having all of their hospitality taken, they receive nothing in return from Magellan and his men. And so they climb aboard Magellan's ships. They look for things that they can take. They're fascinated. It's very likely that that Chamorros at that time were already familiar with metal, because they immediately are drawn to it, fascinated, you know, because knowing that this is something of value. And whereas Magellan's scribe, Pigafetta, portrays Magellan and his men as victims who were simply defending themselves, that the Chamorros were thieves. Some of Magellan's sailors, however, basically say that Magellan and his men were afraid of being overpowered. They were sickly, and that the Chamorros were stronger and so on. But ultimately, violence breaks out. Chamorros flee the ships. Magellan goes ashore the next day, burns down a village, kills at least seven Chamorros, and Magellan is actually chased away, chased away onto his next destination by Chamorros, who hold up the bodies of their relatives that he has killed. And so in the initial encounter here, Magellan and his men call the island of Guam Isla de las Velas Latinas, the island of Latin sails, marveling at the canoes. But after the exchange of violence, they curse Guam with the name Isla de los Ladrones, the Island of Thieves, a name that sticks for hundreds of years.
So Spain obviously has marked Guam on the map, and in the 17th century, Spain formally colonized Guam. Why was its location so valuable to Spain? Why was Spain keen to colonize Guam?
And so initially, Spain's interest in Guam was largely religious. There wasn't a lot of value to Guam in terms of spices, in terms of gold. It was really religious. The Jesuits, in particular, a man named San Vitoris, he was interested in bringing Catholicism to Guam, saving the souls of the natives there. And he had enough pull back home in Spain to make it happen. And so Guam remained somewhat important because it was on the route of the Manila galleon trade, the Manila Acapulco galleon trade for a time. But then for much of the Spanish period, Guam was not economically important because the Spanish colonies in the Americas gained their independence, and Spain as an empire began to decline substantially. And so there was discussions, you know, by the late 1700s, by the 1800s, about just letting Guam go or what should happen to Guam, because Spain's days as an empire was numbered by that point.
You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio. It's This Week in History. The date that we're basing history on tonight is the American occupation of Guam, but we're just doing a little bit of looking at the history before that in Guam with Dr. Michael Bevacqua, who's a Chamorro scholar and author. He's taught Guam University and he's a curator at the Guam Museum. So, Michael, what impact did Spanish rule then have on the Chamorro people? How did they fare during that time that Spain was trying to proselytize to the locals?
Oh, Spain had a huge dramatic and traumatic impact on Chamorro life. Spain brings priests into the island, and there are several decades of sporadic conflict, the Chamorro-Spanish wars, in which Chamorros largely resist the Catholic presence in their lives. And in fact, at that time, the Marianas Islands are the most dangerous place in the world for Jesuit priests because of the warfare that is happening at that time. Ultimately, Chamorros do not win these wars, and the Spanish Empire Catholicism wins, and Chamorros are forced to adapt to this new religion and hybridize it to their own sort of ancestral beliefs. And by the start of the 1800s, Chamorro life has become much more Hispanicized, but very much in an island way nonetheless. And so Chamorros by that time have started to wear clothes, whereas their ancestors a few generations earlier went largely naked. Chamorros still speak their native language, but now, for example, the ancient Austronesian numbers Hatsa, Hugua, Tulu, Fatfat have been replaced with Unu, Dos, Tres, Cuatro, which we still use up until today. And even the diet of the Chamorro people changes at this time because of the close connection where Guam falls under the control or the authority of the Philippines. And so Guam and the Philippines and the Mexico connection mean that food changes. So tortillas, or as we call them, tatizas, come into the Chamorro diet, for example. And then even something as simple as cockfighting becomes very popular at this time through sort of the cultural changes during the Spanish period. And one of the biggest changes, though, is, of course, that while Chamorros initially resist Catholicism, by the end of the Spanish period, Chamorros are almost entirely Catholic and faithfully Catholic.
And does that change the status that the women had traditionally had in Chamorro culture?
Ooh. And so women were most likely some of the most resistant figures to the Spanish presence because it would mean the loss of their status. And the Catholic religion at that time didn't offer them much authority, much power, and so on. And so Chamorro women really hold out in their support and their participation in the church for a very long time. But Eventually, though, when the Catholic Church changes its approach in Guam to how it represents itself. So what we see, for example, in the middle of the 1700s, the 18th century, we see the church no longer represented in Guam through male figures, but through versions of Mary, for example, female figures, patronesses and saints, and, you know, Mary, the mother of Jesus. And that Chamorro women are encouraged to form their own sort of societies and for groups to embrace the church in their own way. And once the church allows Chamorro women to participate and have some autonomy in it, and also to see sort of women as having power in the church, it allows Chamorro women to adapt their own sort of identity inside the church, and they become much more embracing of it.
So let's jump to 1898. What was happening in the Spanish-American War when the United States arrived in Guam?
And so by the time 1898 comes around, the Spanish Empire, of course, is falling apart. There's revolutions that are happening, rebellions that are happening everywhere else. And Guam is almost completely disconnected information-wise, but from a lot of these things. So Guam does not know about many of these things taking place. And so while war has broken out in the Caribbean between Spain and the United States, and that while U.S. ships are heading to Manila to fight the Spanish, Guam does not know about what is going on. And so that is why when Henry Glass is given orders in Hawaii that on his way to go to Manila to join the fight there against the Spanish, he is to stop in Guam to take the island. He's only supposed to spend a few days there. If Spanish resistance is too much, he's just supposed to give up and keep going. But he's supposed to take the island, keep going. And so when he gets there, it's like this incredible comedy of errors that happens, because on the one hand, those American troops that are with him, they don't know much about Guam either. And so while the war is going on around them, as they're sailing down the coast of Guam, there's all these rumors that the Spanish have a secret armada hidden in Guam. And as they're sailing into Guam's main harbor at Apra, there's these forts there, and they realize that their cannons can't hit some of those forts, and they're tensing up because they think that the Spanish have laid a trap for them, when in truth, the Spanish have abandoned those forts. There's nothing in those forts. But so Henry Glass and his men go into Apra Harbor, and they're on edge thinking that the Spanish have something here. But when they go there, there's absolutely nothing there. And so they decide to fire some warning shots towards one of the forts that is in Apra Harbor. And the only response that they get is that there is a rowboat with some fishermen in it, with some Chamorro fishermen in it, and they freak out and paddle away furiously. And so while Henry Glass and his men are preparing to invade the island, unsure because the Spanish, they fired into the fort. The fort has not responded at all. They don't know what's going on at all. A boat approaches Glass's ship, and it has some finely dressed Spaniards on board who are requesting, who are welcoming the Americans to the island, who are completely oblivious that war has happened. And one of the things, when they soon learn that the shots that were fired were warnings because they were an act of war, it soon revealed that one of the things that these Spaniards had come aboard to request was that they wanted to borrow some gunpowder so that they might be able to fire back, so that they could return
the shots,
thinking that it was a lovely salute, maybe, you know, because Americans like to go boom, boom, and so we will go boom, boom back.
Oh, oops. So once everyone realized their mistake, was there a bit of, okay, you can have Guam then, or did the Spanish put up any kind of resistance to the Americans?
The Spanish put up no resistance. There was no real presence on Guam at that time. In fact, when I would teach Guam history, I would say, historians say this was a bloodless sort of coup, a bloodless overthrow. But in truth, it wasn't really a bloodless overthrow, because what happened was that when they were disarming some of the soldiers on the island, some of them fainted and fell and hit their heads. And so there was a little bit of blood. And then there was one woman who was reported to have gone into labor when she heard the Americans were invading the island. And so that's all the blood
Okay,
at
not a
that time.
lot, not a lot compared to other conflicts, other takeovers in the history of the world. Yeah, Dr. Michael Bevacqua is here, a Chamorro scholar and author. He's taught Guam history for many years. He's now the curator at Guam Museum. So what happened when the Americans took over Guam? How did life in Guam change?
Oh, and so the arrival of the Americans brought a lot of promise and potential, but it also sort of brought in some sobering realities. And so, America was a new country on the block, as they say. And so there was a lot of hope that Chamorros, which had been largely cut out of a lot of opportunities under the Spanish, that they might be able to now participate more in the economy on the island, participate more in the governing of their island. But instead, what happened was that the United States set up a military government, a naval government on the island of Guam. And so for before prior to World War II on the island, there was regular pushes by Chamorros for greater rights, greater, perhaps US citizenship. But the United States did build up the infrastructure on the island. They employed more people. And they helped develop a middle class on the island, which was in contrast to the Spanish, which had done very little to economically develop the island.
So let's jump to World War II, which brought another dramatic chapter. What happened when Japan invaded Guam in 1941?
Oh, and so the Japanese invasion of the island, it was 32 months, the occupation, but it was very traumatizing for the people. And so part of what made it very traumatizing was that the United States was in control of the island. The United States had proposed itself as being this strong military power, that no one would dare to invade the island, that there was war swirling around in other places. And, Japan was fighting on the continent. There was fighting in Europe. But the United States was proposing that it was powerful. No one would dare to challenge its might. And so, but while the United States was telling the Chamorro people that on Guam, in truth, it was anticipating that Japan was going to attack. And so it had evacuated its dependents from the island a few in October of 1941. All of sort of the wives of Navy officers, their children were evacuated from Guam for safety. They were preparing for a Japanese invasion. And so on December 8th of 1941, just a few hours after Pearl Harbor was bombed, Guam was bombed by the Japanese. And some Chamorros expected this, anticipated this. They had friends who worked for the US Navy, who secretly told them, prepare for war. The Japanese are likely to attack. Hide food. Be ready. But for the majority of Guam's 22,000 people at that time, it was a shock. Because December 8th is the biggest Catholic celebration on the island for the patron saint, the patroness saint of the island, Santa Maria Camilin. So Chamorros were either in church when the bombs fell, or they were preparing for a big feast that day. And so the fact that bombs fell, that Guam was drawn into war in that moment, really shocked everyone's consciousness and really made everything even more traumatizing. And so the Japanese at the, invaded a few days later, occupied the island quite quickly because the United States only had a few hundred troops on Guam. And the occupation was brutal at the beginning, and then it settled into sort of a routine for a few years, and then it got very brutal and very sort of violent towards the end. And part of it was that the Japanese intended to stay for a long time. They didn't, they thought that They would push the United States back at Pearl Harbor, and then they would reinforce themselves across the Pacific and across Asia, and that they would stay in Guam. So they had no, so they intended to be in Guam for a while. They set up schools in Guam to teach the Chamorro people Japanese. They even set up cherry blossom festivals, sumo wrestling events to try to expose Chamorros to Japanese culture. But Chamorros in Guam were not really fooled by this, because at the same time, Japanese soldiers could smack you in the face if you didn't bow low enough to them. Or a Japanese soldier could come to your farm and could basically steal anything he wanted from you for himself. Or it became very common for Chamorros to hide their daughters, to make their daughters dress and pretend to be boys. And for some young women who wanted to avoid being sexually assaulted, it was common for them to take animal feces and to cover their bodies with it, or to hide it in their pockets to try to keep Japanese soldiers from assaulting them. And so by the time, and so as the war turned against the Japanese and the Americans roared back across the Pacific defeating them, the Japanese became more and more cruel and brutal towards the Chamorro people. So by the time June of 1944, July of 1944 came, and the United States was circling around the Marianas and was circling around the Japanese forces in Guam, any semblance of order amongst the Japanese troops and any sense of decorum in how they treated the Chamorro people had disappeared. And so in the final weeks of the Japanese occupation, we see several massacres take place, where the Japanese, angry because they feel that soon they will lose and they are expected to die for their country, they're expected to die for the emperor, and they know they cannot win, they take it out in drunken massacres of 30 Chamorros here, 50 Chamorros there, in different places across the island. And so the Japanese period, the Japanese occupation is one in which every year up until when you visit Guam, in almost every single village up until today, you will see, sometimes small, sometimes a little bit larger, but you will see memorials for places where people were executed, places where people were kept in concentration camps. And so it was only 32 months, but it had a huge searing impact on the island and the people.
Michael, do you have numbers of the Chamorro who would have been, who were killed by the Japanese during that period?
And so it's hard to find exact estimates, but it's estimated that perhaps every 1 in 20.
Gosh, yeah, just terrible. So I understand that the American recapture of Guam in 1944, there must have been a huge sigh of relief, you know, even though these people are still colonizers, that the Americans are back in charge and not the Japanese. But that was quite significant for the way the rest of the war played out, wasn't it? Because Guam played an important, was an important strategic location for the Americans.
Oh, absolutely. So many Chamorros, so this is an important part of sort of the this is an important part in the evolution of Chamorro identity, is that Chamorros prior to World War II didn't, many of them didn't feel a patriotic or close connection to the United States. But through this experience of Japanese occupation, many of them began to hope and to root and to cheer in their own way for an American return. And so one of the things that the Japanese did is that they confiscated and they banned everything American. You couldn't speak the English language. You couldn't have American money on you. You couldn't read anything in English or have American books. And you certainly couldn't have an American flag. And so Chamorros started to, they secretly had songs in which they, in the Chamorro language or in English, that they secretly expressed a desire for America to return. And some would secretly sew American flags. And sometimes they wouldn't have red, white, or blue cloth, so they would sew using whatever cloth that they had, and then they would kind of hide them on their bodies. And so when the United States returned in 1944 and U.S. Marines encountered groups of Chamorros who, you know, had been liberated from concentration camps, you know, sometimes these Chamorros would pull out from their close these flags that they had sewn and that they had and show them to them and say, hey, we're glad that you're back. We're glad that you finally came back, you know. And so up until today, July 21st on Guam is celebrated as Liberation Day, and it is one of the largest public commemorations on Guam, with a big parade, the retelling of the stories of the occupation, and so on.
Guam, though, strategically, isn't this right? It became an American base for long-range B-29 bombers to also take off from that could then strike the Japan's home islands?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And so one of the, this is kind of one of the unfortunate things about being a strategically important territory is that even when you feel, you know, that you might feel happy that America is back and you might feel excited about sort of your relationship to the United States taking on this new form, and that you can now support the United States in this war effort where your island can now be used to attack and bomb the Japan directly, and so that you can contribute to the war effort in this way. One of the things that happens from this, from right after the war, though, is that the United States then begins to take Chamorro lands for new bases. And so prior to World War II, Guam had been a sleepy Navy base. The naval presence on Guam had been quite small. After World War II, though, Guam's strategic value, it enhances enormously. And so the United States Navy, even after the war is over, condemns the lands of Chamorro farmers, you know, by the hundreds, by the thousands of acres, pushing off families left and right, even after the Japanese have surrendered and been defeated. And so one of the things that makes sort of the Liberation Day makes it a little bit kind of tragic is that while Chamorros were grateful for to the United States, Uncle Sam took advantage of that gratitude then to take the land from 1,000 families to build new Air Force bases, new Navy bases. And at the highest point, 2/3 of the entire island of Guam was U.S. military facilities.
You're on Nightlife. It's This Week in History. My guest is Dr. Michael Bevacqua, a Chamorro scholar and author. He's a curator at the Guam Museum. Now, is it true that some Japanese soldiers continued hiding in Guam's jungles long after the war?
Oh, it is absolutely true that there were what are called Japanese stragglers after the war. And at early on, there would have been thousands, and then hundreds, and then eventually dozens. And then by the time the late 50s came around, it was assumed that Japanese stragglers were just rumors, that, you know, that if you somebody was stealing, you know, that if chickens were disappearing off your property, it was your neighbor, it wasn't a Japanese straggler who was doing it. In 1960, though, two Japanese stragglers were found. And this was 16 years after the war had ended. And people thought these must be the last two. There can't be any more. Who else could be hiding out here? But one of those stragglers knew that there was other stragglers who were still hiding out there. And so he returned to Guam soon after and went around the island yelling, encouraging people, some of his comrades, come out. It's okay to come out. Please come out. Come home. It's okay. He was actually wounded when in a rock slide while he was in the jungle trying to find more stragglers. But when he went home in 1960, many people said, there cannot be any more. It's been 16 years since the war ended. And so in 1972, when Sergeant Yokoi was found 28 years after the war had ended, it made worldwide headlines. And because he was believed at that time to be the last Japanese straggler anywhere in the world. And he ended up not being. But it was huge news when he was found. And so some people believe that Yokoi did not know that the war was over. But of course he knew that the war was over. But he was worried about repercussions, that he might be hurt, that he might be killed. He was worried about dishonor. He was worried about many things. But even after he went back to Japan, he felt uncomfortable and never truly at home in modern Japan, post-war Japan. And he always felt like there was a piece of him that remained in Guam. So he returned several times back to Guam.
Wow, what an incredible story. Now, Michael, we've talked to you for quite a while. We don't have too much time, but I would really like to understand just a bit about how Guam's political status has evolved since World War II. And I guess that tension between, what rights do Guamanians have? You're not citizens of the US, but is there a push for independence? Like, what is life like for Guamanians, particularly people of Chamorro descent today?
Oh, yes. And so Guam today is, within the United States, an unincorporated territory. Internationally, we are a non-self-governing territory. Now, within the United States, this means that we have U.S. passports, we're U.S. citizens, but we don't get to vote for U.S. president. We don't have electoral college votes. We don't have voting representation in the U.S. Congress. And we don't have voting power or sovereignty within an international framework as well. So we don't get to vote in the United Nations. We can't make deals with other countries or sign treaties or have trade agreements. And so Guam is, on the one hand, cut out from American democracy. We cannot participate as an equal member of the American Union, but we're also cut out from participating as an equal member of the global community too. And so there is in Guam a strong push for political status change. Now, in terms of what direction though, the community is divided. And so usually when there are polls about this statehood or being fully integrated, a full and equal member of the United States is the most popular choice. But in the past 10 years, independence has grown, especially amongst young people, as a popular option. In some polls, as many as one third of respondents sometimes express a preference for Guam becoming more autonomous in relation to the United States.
I have many more questions, but I'm afraid we are out of time, Michael. But thank you so much for giving us this sort of potted history of Guam's history. It's been so interesting to talk to you. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you so much for having me.
That is Dr. Michael Bevacqua. He's a Chamorro scholar and author. He's been a teacher of Guam history. He's a curator at Guam Museum.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.